VOA Weather Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, Dan Novak, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Thousands of jobless workers in Ho Chi Minh City are fleeing to their hometowns as the city extends coronavirus restrictions. Ho Chi Minh City is Vietnam's largest city and is now the center of the country's worst outbreak since the start of the pandemic. Many people are leaving town on motorbikes with their belongings loaded high. But officials are trying to prevent them from leaving and possibly spreading the virus to other parts of the country. Hundreds of motorbikes have been stopped at roadblocks around the city since Sunday. Television video from areas outside of the city on Monday showed factory workers wearing full protective clothing. They were hurrying to get on trains and buses in a similar attempt to flee the most affected areas. Officials with loudspeakers ordered people to continue social distancing and return to their homes. The sound of danger signals and shouting was everywhere as people attempted to leave. Ho Chi Minh City has had most of the country's 6,141 coronavirus deaths, with more than 283,000 reported cases. The city of 9 million people is seeing, on average, 241 deaths every day. Many people are struggling to survive after losing jobs because of coronavirus-related suspensions of factory work. The Vietnamese government has announced that it will give out financial aid to its citizens. Nguyen Van Hoan was traveling toward the central province of Ha Tinh, about 1,200 kilometers from Ho Chi Minh City, by road. "This is not my first attempt. I tried to leave the city weeks ago, but was ordered to return to my place," he said. Juan lost his job 2 months ago. On his motorbike, he had put a suitcase, a supply of instant foods, water, and a container of gasoline. "Many people in my neighborhood have died," he told the Reuters news agency by phone. "If I stay, I'll die either from hunger and stress or from the virus," he said. Huan added that he had not gotten any aid from the government. Healthcare centers and hospitals are now overcrowded, and hospitals have a shortage of workers. The government has ordered medical centers not to refuse patients. I'm Alice Bryant.
as schools in the U.S. start to reopen for the autumn, coronavirus cases among children are rising with the new Delta variant. But some state policymakers and their school district leaders disagree about how to safely reopen schools. Last month, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, changed its guidance. It is now advising school districts to require masks for all students, teachers, and workers. This includes people who have been fully vaccinated. The country's two largest school districts, New York City and Los Angeles, are requiring its teachers to be vaccinated or face weekly COVID testing. California recently became the first state to require vaccines or weekly testing for all teachers and school workers. But several Republican-led states have passed laws or signed executive orders that ban school districts from following the CDC guidance. Schools in Florida, Texas, Arizona, South Carolina, Utah, Iowa, and Oklahoma are not permitted to require masks for teachers and students, Forbes reported. In the United States, support for vaccines and mask wearing is largely divided along political party lines. Monmouth University in New Jersey released a public opinion study this month measuring Americans' opinions about masking and vaccines. The study found that 85% of Democrats support new mask requirements, while 73% of Republicans oppose it. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis banned schools in the state from requiring masks. He called mask wearing a choice that parents should make and not the government. But some districts in the state are choosing not to listen to the governor's order. In Florida's Leon County, which includes the state capital of Tallahassee, masks are being required in elementary and middle schools. The first day of class in the county was last week. County School Superintendent Rocky Hanna made the announcement at a recent press conference. "I did a lot of soul searching, a lot of thinking," he said. "If we lost a child to this virus, I can't just simply blame the governor of the state of Florida. I can't."
Sarah Lee is a mother of two 10-year-old twins attending school in Leon County. She told VOA that their school required masks during the spring term as well. She said wearing masks did not prevent her kids from learning or communicating, as Governor DeSantis has suggested. "I was relieved when our school board went against our governor," Lee said. The Broward County, Florida Teachers Union said Thursday that four of its teachers died of COVID-19 within 2 days. The county school board had voted to require mask wearing. DeSantis has threatened not to pay school leaders who do not follow his order. Last week, Florida set records for the number of coronavirus hospitalizations for 12 straight days. The Arizona Republic says 10 school districts in Phoenix, Arizona, are requiring mask wearing, even though a state law prevents mask or vaccine requirements. A group of 26 Republican lawmakers in the state are pushing for Governor Doug Ducey, also a Republican, not to give federal money to school districts that have mask requirements. George Lyle has a stepson who attends high school in one of the Phoenix school districts that is ignoring the governor's order. His stepson is vaccinated, but he thinks that in an environment right now where the Delta variant is spreading so rapidly, I think it would make sense to require masks in schools, he told VOA. Texas has also banned mask and vaccine mandates. Under Texas law, schools in the state do not even need to tell parents if there has been an outbreak of COVID-19 in a school. The Dallas Independent School District started school August 16th. It is ignoring the Texas governor's order and requiring masking. The district said on its website that the governor's order does not establish reasonable and necessary safety rules for its teachers, workers, and students. About 40% of new COVID-19 cases in the United States have come from Texas and Florida. Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Florida's DeSantis have both resisted efforts to prevent the spread of the virus since the pandemic started. Both are close allies of former President Donald Trump. Both are considering running in the 2024 presidential election.
Michael Steele is the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. He told The Washington Post that Abbott, DeSantis, and other Republican governors are making a political bet on the lives of the people they serve. Few school districts are planning for a return to online or hybrid learning, though the number is growing. Hybrid learning includes a mix of both online and in-person classes. The publication Education Week found that 20% of school district leaders questioned said they will have hybrid models. That is up from 10% a month earlier. Less than 1% of school leaders say they are planning for full-time remote learning. Lee, the parent in Florida, said her young children struggled at times while learning remotely. She said she hopes the masks will help prevent an outbreak. We've learned that it's probably better for them to be in school, Lee said. She added, "It's interesting to me that last year in this time we were remote learning, and now the virus is worse and it affects younger kids more, so we are sending them to school. I'm just worried about the spread." I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton, He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as the revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very, very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was something that was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. It's a very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gordon says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet, they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the capital was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the capital must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.